Chapter 4. The American Dream. Getting here is the first step. Graffiti on the Statue of Liberty. The engineering job Ash took in England required long hours, concentration, time in the office, as well as expected time socializing with clients from all over the globe. A true empirical company demands a life of its employees as if it owns them head to toe. So, young Ash, already married 1 year after a true Bollywood-style wedding in India, gave of himself, because this was really his first important job, and because, like most motivated future entrepreneurs, he wanted and needed to make a great impression on his employer. And there is no bigger impression to make at that stage in your life than to arrive at work early and be the last to leave at night. "I want you to understand, Indira, the company's very demanding. They want the best of me, and although I sometimes think I should give them blood to prove my worth and allegiance, there are many tasks to be completed daily. So, as the new kid in town, many of those tasks are passed over to me after closing time. I have to work these hours, my love." Indira shrugged this off. After all, they were in London, where she had a bevy of girlfriends, each from a different economic and tribal background, all married too, and experiencing a similar upswing lifestyle. Her friends' husbands were as busy as Ash. They made similar salaries, as each couple wanted to improve their social status, no matter the price to be paid at the office. Those were the people in the Jeffreys' life. Aside, of course, from their immediate families, with whom they spent time every Sunday afternoon like clockwork, there were no children then. There was a close friend named Gary Truby. Just recently married in Barbados, he possessed a catchy personality that could convince a turtle to abandon its shell. Ash thought he would design his life to look like his. "If I could only charm people the way he does, I would be successful beyond my wildest dreams," he thought. Because people like Gary did not stand on every street corner. Gary dresses like a millionaire. His material possessions describe him to the teeth. His manner of speech is faultless, and he takes over the room when walking in. "I have a surprise for you, Indira," said Ash. Always loving the sound of her name, always wanting to mouth it so to feel her near, Indira loved surprises. As a little girl, her father would wait in the house as she was about to walk in the door, and hidden in some nook or cranny, he would jump out of nowhere to scare her, nearly giving Indira a heart attack in the process. The two would laugh heartily, father feeling closer to this little girl, Indira trembling in delight, a smirk on her face. Now Ash had a genuine surprise in store for her. "Do you know the Roby House? You love architecture, so you should be familiar with it." Ash waited for the name to register in Indira's head. While she searched her memory, Ash waited for his wife's response. Indira rarely reacted or responded to questions, as she was cool as a midnight breeze, taking the time to caress your face, to remind you of the power of nature. Now, though, she squinted and looked deep into Ash's eyes. "The Roby House?" she asked. "Isn't that the Frank Lloyd Wright structure in Chicago?"
"It is a house, yes."
"And what should I know about the Roby House? Are we going to live there?" The two laughed heartily. No one would ever again live in the Roby House. Not after William Zeckendorf, a prominent Chicago businessman, bought it and quickly donated it to the University of Chicago. The house was long a national historic landmark in the United States, the very first architectural work considered to be purely of the American style. In fact, this style was coined the Prairie School due to its Midwest smartness. Frank Lloyd Wright came to be known as perhaps the single greatest architect of all time as a result of all his work. The Roby House is commonly seen as a masterpiece because the architect designed not only the house, but its furniture, textiles, doors and windows, the landscaping, because as he said, it is impossible to design only one thing without the other. The idea of anyone, even a king, residing there was but a dream. Indira had a sense of humor after all, and she knew it. Because Ash did not answer after laughing along with her, Indira thought he might have another question. Instead, she prodded him. "Are we going on holiday to Chicago?"
"No," answered Ash, but I sure would like to live there, wouldn't you? Indira, not having the same killer instinct with people as her husband did, shrugged. She still wanted to hear the surprise mentioned.
So, tell me the surprise,
she ordered in a gentle manner, with no hurry in her voice. There's a job opening there, and I wanted to know if you were interested in living in America. Chicago proved to be a more difficult city to navigate than London. What with its interminable one-way streets, landmarks, and cluttered traffic, London travel was a mostly underground experience, and so driving the car was, for Ash Jeffrey, more of a nuisance than a pleasure. But armed to the teeth with inspiration and motivated to do well with the aeronautics company that served the United States Army for starts, Ash poured all of himself into this new opportunity, spending only late nights at home with Indira. In time, the boss would see his brilliant work, Ash would make new friends, he would ask his parents to visit, set up a nice house in the suburbs, and settle down to life others only dreamed of. It was like being in a movie, Indira thought, with everything falling into place. As she was yet to welcome their first child, time was to be used as efficiently as possible. After 3 months of solitude at home with everything in its place, there were interests to take up. So Indira started ceramic classes, took long walks in the neighborhood, and started to secretly write a journal. She titled The Dream of the Butterflies. In it, she shared her life with Ash, who in her writing was represented by a lion. Indira was the cub, learning to trip and fall, leaping skyward to play with the green and red winged butterflies that surrounded her, all to no avail, as the flying insects proved to be great escape artists. She did not think the roles might be reversed in their daily life, that she was the lion and he the butterfly. Yet the idea of chronicling their experiences through fantasy was a gratifying adventure that made her glow with pride. The journal was her personal secret, something she did just for her, and shared with no one because, as her mother taught her during childhood, an individual must have a corner of their soul be private. In other words, keep something powerful inside you without ever sharing it with anyone. This will make you strong. It will give you a powerful identity. Today, unfortunately, the newspapers were filled with every single photograph, word, and action of movie stars and celebrities, as if they wanted the world to know every little thing about them, with nothing being kept private, not even the private parts. How ridiculous, muttered Indira. These people simply give themselves away. They have no mystery about them. The new Chicago-based boss, a great, humble man of enviable taste, invited the Jeffreys to dinner at his home, to meet the wife and children and chat about life as a way to get to know one another. The food was exceptional, as was the California wine, while dessert not surprisingly included chocolate mousse to please Indira. The boss showed his house from room to room, an astounding piece of architecture recently completed. Its pink stone interior walls reminiscent of ancient times, the imported Scandinavian furniture of splendor, and the artwork impressive in its Mexican masterpieces. The boss told of acquiring American sculptures from local auctions, donated Japanese ceramic pieces from nonprofit organizations in desperate need to survive, and African masks and spears from a trip to Kenya where he went lion hunting. I never shot my gun, as I respect all life. I'm a Buddhist in that respect, I suppose. The boss was more than satisfied with his life, as per the material evidence to prove it. I would like to someday contribute to the needy, Ash thought, without speaking the words. The boss would one day have a building at the University of Chicago named after him. How impressive. When Indira went to the kitchen to help clean up, the two men sat in the library to sip a fine bottle of Napoleon VSOP cognac, circa 1920. Ash, the boss began, I want you to know that in very little time you have mastered moving our projects ahead, as if by nature. We are quite impressed with this, and so we have decided to accept more orders and projects and take more work. We will be asking you to handle a bigger load for completion, Now, the projects will have deadlines, and as you've already exceeded our expectations regarding time and efficiency, we will target a date and wait for you. For example, if we need completion by March 15th and you finish early, we'll review and submit your work and continue on with the next one. And for this, you will be handsomely compensated with a bonus. You have a big future with us, Ash. Our clients love to receive the work on time, let alone early. This makes us look good. Ash smiled and nodded, agreeing with the boss and accepting the new challenge. There was nothing to disagree with, as the boss was promoting him in a figure of speech. His boss, in turn, felt a tinge of the father in him, for Ash was like the son he never had. Ash thought of the opportunity to grow with the company with a heavier workload, for what was life without some serious challenges? He would take this work head-on, make a name for himself, and move up the social ladder, where he felt he belonged. His was not a rags-to-riches story. It was the story of a man who was simply doing what he was meant to do, because in his head, the world was waiting for him to arrive. And although aerospace engineering was for others a difficult profession, to Ash it was like swimming in a quiet lake, or like going for walks to solve other people's problems. Like the gorgeous Japanese ceramic sculptures in the living room, Ash would one day create his masterpiece. But his clay mold was still wet. It was waiting to be placed in the kiln for the finished product. The idea of solving other people's problems as a guru was not yet a firm one, as Ash was still sculpting his own life. What Ash did not realize right off the bat was that he was already leading the pack, what with his brilliant work and result-oriented mind. Indira applauded when told of his new position, though it was not really a different job. It was simply a heavier load to carry. He would stay in the same office, sharing the same secretary with his colleague next door, and lunch daily in the building because for him going out to lunch was a distraction. As a focused individual, Ash preferred to stay with his train of thought while at work, as this proved to be a more effective way to work. Early on, he discovered that eating in the cafeteria or in the office gave him the chance to take notes and carry on with his work uninterrupted. But then others started to sit with him, taking his concentration away from the tasks at hand. So one fine day, he decided to stay in his office during lunch, alone. He explained publicly to keep from stirring ill feelings with the staff. He decided the best person to share this with was his now good friend, Gary Truby. You know how the Queen's Guard at Buckingham Palace will not respond to visitors when spoken to, but instead keeps his focus straight ahead? I'm like that guard, staying in my office to remain focused on my work. I suppose it is some kind of insecurity, Gary, but nonetheless, I'm driven to succeed, and I don't know why. Gary Truby took it in stride. But a particular colleague at the office jokingly nicknamed him Einstein for hiding during lunch, like the mathematical genius was known to do while working on his breakthrough formula, E equals MC squared. The job went like this for years. Ash and Indira, happy. The company, too. The boss proud to see Ash make important presentations and bring in the dough. The Christmas bonuses, gifts and parties, sailing invitations on Sundays, the cabins in the summer, weekend vacations to Indira's favorite spots. All in all, heaven in America. Just like they pictured it. Those years were their salad days, a time when truly nothing went wrong, a period they would cherish forever, not once thinking it would change. A bliss we all seek in life but seldom find, yet a true experience for the Jeffreys, who had begun to think of starting a family. Speaking from personal experience, the boss suggested Ash and Indira enjoy a few years together before having children, because life would change once they started a family. The former Londoners did not want life to change just yet, so Indira and Ash lived it up in Chicago. Father-in-law Jeffrey visited for a week, taking time from his high post at Lloyd's of London, where he ran the finance department. Ash's old mates from engineering school passed by on their way out west, and Indira's widowed mother showed up with candles, oils, and incense from her homeland, gifts for her daughter to keep her in the loop of Indian culture and its religious beliefs and practices.
"Burn these candles, Indira. They will cover you with protection," she said. "Your life is so blessed because you live in harmony. You do not forget the gratitude provided. Burning is an offering."
The widow lived immersed in religious practice, like she had for years, particularly since the days when she discovered her only daughter had been taken advantage of by a grown man. At first, she did not believe it. Then she did not want to believe it. Then finally, when she believed it, by looking deeply into Indira's pain-filled eyes, the widow wept in bed until she could weep no more. Hers were the tears of ignorance, she told her neighbors. Ignorance because she walked with her eyes closed when she knew better. For as a mother, one must live with one's eyes open, seeing everything, suspecting everything, allowing nothing to veil the truth of what is so. A mother must have a sense of smell and the ability to attack the intruder at a moment's notice. This is the way to protect one's children, she added, her neighbors agreeing with her every word.
Ignorance will be the end of us as a civilization, she exclaimed, shouting out to all those listening in front of her house the day she exposed the sexual intruder in public,
the shame in her voice visible for all to see, the salty teardrops drenching her sari. They, mothers that they were with girls of their own, knew to keep an eye out for those dirty men who did as they wished and with whom they wished.
A woman's body is her own, she concluded as the crowd dispersed,
dignified and inspired by Indira's mother.
The next man to do such a thing in our neighborhood will have his manhood cut off, for all to see, she declared to those walking off and still within an earshot.
Now the widow basked in her daughter Indira's success in marriage, only looking to address what she saw as the injustice of being brushed off by her mother-in-law, or Ash's mother. Yet it was better not to get in the way. Indira's in-law would sooner or later come around to love her.
"We are not Tamil," she said under her breath to no one.
In America, the dream was now real, and the Jeffreys took to giving prayers of gratitude on a daily basis, burning incense and lighting candles to attain the harmony necessary to continue on with a beautiful, blessed life.